From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this week around our region. And today we are lucky enough to have Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, joining us today. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
So let's begin with open primaries. So to get people caught up, the Open Primaries Initiative has been certified by the Secretary of State, so it is now headed to the ballot in November. But Scott, I really wanted to start today's conversation by talking about the really long history of citizen initiatives in Idaho, because this is something that a lot of folks, Scott, may not be aware of. And you actually recently wrote an opinion piece about this.
Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon called the Open Primaries Initiative a pernicious plot. But really, citizens' initiatives should not be viewed as a pernicious plot. This goes back to our Constitution. The Idaho Constitution has enshrined in it the right of the people, the citizens, to bring an initiative or a referendum. And we have had, over the past 130 years of our statehood, we've had 30 initiatives have made it onto the ballot, with about half of those passing. In looking into this, there were some things that surprised me. Our first referendum, which is a similar process for initiative, was in 1936, where the legislature had passed a 2% sales tax. And the voters of Idaho at the time said, no, not so fast. We don't want a sales tax. And so they held a referendum in 1936 and basically overturned that law. Interestingly enough, 30 years later, in 1966, they gave the go-ahead to a 3% sales tax approved by the legislators that year, recognizing that it was needed. But our first initiative was in 1938 with the establishment of the Idaho Fish and Game Commission. I didn't know that that was a citizen initiative at the time. A couple others are really interesting. The Sunshine Law for political funds and lobbyist activity disclosure, that was passed by citizen initiative in 1974. You can probably imagine why some legislators would be reluctant to pass something like that, but the citizens took it into their own hands and passed that law. The other thing I did not know until I did research on this is that the property tax homeowners exemption was passed by citizen initiative in 1982. And the Idaho Lottery Commission was established by initiative in 1986. And probably most people know the most recent citizen initiative was the Medicaid expansion in 2018 after legislators failed to pass Medicaid expansion and debated about it for years and years. And citizens finally took it into their hands to pass Medicaid expansion in 2018. Mm-hmm. So it really, citizen initiative and referendums have a long and rich history in Idaho.
And Melissa, it is not easy to get an initiative on the ballot by any stretch of the imagination. Can you kind of walk us through what has to happen actually get an initiative on the ballot?
It's not only difficult to get an initiative on the ballot, it's gotten increasingly more difficult over the years as the legislature has weighed in because they've been unhappy at what the voters have done. You know, the rejection of Students Come First in 2012 is another great example. Legislators made these initiatives and referendums more difficult to get on the ballot after that. So now to qualify for that, they need to gather signatures from at least 6% of registered voters across the state. And that used to be enough. But since the 2013 legislative session, they need at least 6% of voters in at least 18 of Idaho's legislative districts. So the idea is, you know, previously you could conceivably get 6% of voters from Ada County, basically. You know, you could get a huge amount of registered voters by standing downtown at the farmers market or going to, you know, Meridian at one of their public concerts and just getting people to sign your petitions. Now, the point of that law in 2013 was to include more voters from rural districts. You know, you have to leave Ada and Canyon counties now to get those signatures. The legislature tried at one point to make it 6% from every legislative district. That was overturned by the court. But it is still a high bar. There have been attempts to get things on the ballot. Legalizing marijuana is one example. They haven't been able to meet that threshold over the course of several years. So it takes a concentrated effort to get that to meet that threshold of the 6% in 18 districts.
And Scott, we should note that this open primaries initiative, what organizers collected something like what, more than 97,000
Yeah,
signatures?
97,000 signatures they collected. They needed about 63,000 estimated signatures, and they ended up with 75,000. So the list did get winnowed down when it went back to the county clerks from the 97,000. But the 75,000 signatures were verified and confirmed this week by the Secretary of State.
And Scott, what does that say to you? I mean, as Melissa just mentioned about how difficult it is to get these signatures, but that you have to go into every part of the state of Idaho, which frankly is fair. When you are trying to get a citizen initiative on the ballot, it shouldn't just be signatures in Ada and Canyon County, but to get that amount of signatures for this initiative.
Yeah, and I think, perhaps Idaho has a sweet spot when it comes to initiatives. There are other states where they have, 10 or 12 or 20 initiatives on a ballot, and that can be cumbersome and a lot for voters. So it is a high bar, but it's not too high. But yeah, it says that there's enough interest, and this topic has been talked about for a long time, about trying to get rid of the closed primary system, which was started. The Republican primary was closed in 2012, and it has led to extremist candidates running and winning in primaries and then winning in the general election. And so this has been seen as a problem for a long time. And so I think when it finally came to this point of getting this on the ballot, I think there were a lot of people ready and willing to sign the petition and get it over the finish line to make sure this gets on the ballot.
It's
So
important
Melissa,
to note,
oh, go
though, that
ahead.
this is beyond just opening up the primary and allowing any registered
Right.
voter to participate in any party's primary. This is ranked choice voting, where during the primary, instead of going party by party, you pick your favorite candidate, and then you have the option of saying, okay, and this is my second favorite, and this is my third favorite, and this is my fourth favorite. That's confusing to a lot of voters, and I think that's going to be a hurdle. You had the first hurdle, right, of getting people to sign the petition in the first place. Now you have the hurdle of convincing people that this is a good idea, and part of that is making sure they understand it. And I've talked to people, in the course of reporting for Idaho Reports during the season, during the signature gathering process, people who were in the legislature for a long time who said, look, I wasn't a fan of the closed primaries, but I can't quite sign on to ranked choice voting. I would rather just do away with closed primaries. So these are different things. And I think that explaining that system and how it works to voters, it's going to be interesting to see how they do that, how supporters do that on a wide statewide scale to get that simple
So
majority needed to pass this.
let's talk about that a little bit more in depth, Melissa, because I completely understand open primaries, right? I mean, because they used to be open. It meant that no matter what you who how you were registered, it was one primary. You didn't walk in there and have, do you want the Republican primary? Do you want the Democratic one? And you had to choose. And if you weren't a Republican, you can't vote in the Republican open primary. I mean, the closed primary. That's pretty simple to understand. I have discussed ranked choice voting numerous times on this program. I don't think I'm too dumb, but I have to say, I still have to really stop and wrap my head around what ranked choice voting means. Because does that mean I do that in the primary, or do I do it in the general, or do I only do it in the primary? And can I put a Republican on the ballot and a Democrat on the ballot? So can you kind of explain this to us?
Yeah, during the primary, you get a ballot with all the candidates who have filed, and you pick your favorite. So you no longer have to worry, okay, I am not only a registered Republican, but I've been a registered Republican for this many months, and so I'm eligible to vote in this primary. There are all the candidates in a big old pile on your ballot for this legislative district or this seat or whatever. And you pick your favorite one. I don't know what the ballot would look like. We're not, that if this passes, that seems like that's a next year problem for the county clerks. But you pick your number one, and then you have the choice of saying, and then this is my number two favorite, and this is my number three favorite, and this is my number four favorite. And then from there, the county clerks then figure out the top vote getters. And basically, it's sorted in order of preference, and the four top vote getters. Sorry, the oh my gosh, I'm messing it up. The two top vote getters
The two
end
top
up on
vote getters go
general
on to the general.
election. Right, the general election ballot has the two top vote getters, and then in the general election, you vote for only one candidate.
Okay, and
So
with that.
again, I've been pretty familiar with this, and even though I understood it, I just screwed up the explanation of it. And so,
No, you didn't.
a little bit. And so that's going to be the challenge. And
Yeah.
I obviously am covering a lot of other things. There are people who are dedicated to this full time who are going to be explaining this to voters, and they're going to be a lot more eloquent about it than I am. But that's still, I think, the hurdle in everyday conversations with just like, okay, I think I have this. This is what it's going to look like. They have several months to get that messaging down. And remember, this is a very organized group. They were organized enough to get it on the ballot in the first place for November, and that was a high hurdle. They have qualified other initiatives before, people who are in this coalition who support this effort. They're professionals at this. But it is challenging. Medicaid expansion was a challenging message to
Yes.
sell in a state like Idaho, and they were able to get that over the finish line pretty comfortably.
So
Go
what I was
ahead.
going to say is that, what's interesting to me about this then, Melissa, is that when you have those two candidates, right? And so you basically have ranked them 1, 2, 3, 4, who your favorites are, and then through a process, the top two go on to the general. You could then have two Republicans for let's say running for governor. You could have, right? I mean, so it's not just, oh, we're going to see a Democrat and we're going to see a Republican on the ballot. And let's be honest, in a state like Idaho, we might just see in the general election almost all Republicans on the ballot.
That's been one of the arguments against this system from minority parties in other states. But again, other states are so different than Idaho. And different states have different approaches to this, but there have absolutely been races where there have been, major elections where only two Democrats end up getting through that initial primary system. And that's who people have to choose from. People who support this effort would say, realistically, this gives, if the majority of voters in Canyon County, for example, are conservative, this gives them more of a say in who ends up being their representative, as opposed to only registered Republican voters who show up in the primary. And it's more representative. And there are a lot of people who have very grave concerns about how confusing this is and about how it might alienate voters and reduce voter participation in the primary. We're going to see, I think, a lot of money go into both sides of this campaign leading up to the general. And I think, this is going to be the most interesting election by far anywhere in the state. That's obviously everyone's going to be looking at the presidential results in November, and but here in Idaho, we're going to be really looking at that voter initiative and those returns.
So, Scott, you mentioned at the top of our conversation that Dorothy Moon, who's the head of the Idaho GOP, has called this initiative a pernicious plot. Couldn't one argue it's just democracy at work because it's giving voters more voice in who they want to see in office, and then being able to hold those people holding office more accountable to all of their constituents.
For sure. And just to clarify, the primary is going to send four candidates to the general election. So you're just going to vote for one candidate in the primary, and you're going to have a choice of all candidates and all parties. You could have up to 10 candidates or more. You might have just two candidates or three candidates in the primary, but you pick one, and the top four vote getters move on to the general election. And then in the general election, you have that ranked choice voting. So you pick one, two, three, four, your top choice, your second choice. You can choose one, two, three, four. You don't have to choose all four choices, but you can. And then the process is winnowed down in that instant runoff. And so you could have, you know, for example, you could be a Democrat who has a Democratic candidate that's your favorite choice in the general election, but probably that person is not going to win in a heavily Republican state or county or district. And so there are two Republicans on the ballot. And so you might choose as your second choice the more moderate Republican. And so if your candidate is eliminated, your second choice, your vote goes to your second choice candidate, which might be the more Republican, the more moderate Republican in that race. And like Melissa said, it is the tabulation part of it is confusing. I think the voting part of it is not confusing. I think it's pretty simple for voters to choose your top four in order of preference. The tabulation and how the results are winnowed down are a little more difficult, but it does open it up at the very least. It opens the primary up to the entire state. You know, independents can't vote. There are 270,000 independents in unaffiliated voters who can't vote in the Republican primary. Now they will be able to vote in a primary if this passes. And then you can choose among your four candidates in the general election, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian or a Constitution Party. And I talked to a filmmaker who covered this story in Alaska, and he said that the Libertarian candidate was invited to the debate in the general election in Alaska because he was among the top four candidates. And he asked the moderators if that wasn't the case, would the Libertarian candidate even been invited to the debate? And the moderator said, probably not. We probably just would have focused on the Republican and Democratic candidates. So these third party candidates and independent candidates are probably going to benefit. And I think we're going to see more candidates go out to run because there's a greater chance that they'll make it at least to the general election and be there in November for people to pick among them.
So before we go into break, next steps in this, it will be on the ballot come November 5th.
Barring a lawsuit. And so there have been threats of a lawsuit based on whether it is a two subject, it violates the Constitution's requirement of a single subject. And so because there are two parts to this, there's the open primary and the ranked choice voting. There's some, including Attorney General Raul Labrador, has suggested that this is unconstitutional because it's two separate subjects. The organizers, of course, say, no, it's just one subject. It's election reform. And so it is constitutional. So we might, now that it's on the ballot, that it's been confirmed by the Secretary of State, now the race begins to see whether somebody files a lawsuit to try to keep it off the ballot.
So, Melissa, can you talk to us about the Attorney General's office petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court? This is in regards to the Fairness in Women's Sports Act.
Yes, the Fairness in Women's Sports Act was passed in 2020, and it basically states that that people who were assigned male at birth or biological males are not allowed to compete in women's sports if they identify as transgender women. There are multiple lawsuits about similar laws in other states that have made their way through various levels of court, and the Attorney General, Raul Labrador, is asking the Supreme Court to basically weigh in and resolve all of these differing lawsuits. Different courts have said different things about the constitutionality of these laws. And so basically the Labrador's office is saying, you know what, let's resolve this once and for all instead of having these disparate rulings for basically the same issue.
So what happens now that they've petitioned the US Supreme Court? We just now wait to see what the court says. But also, has the court gone into recess? So will this be a while before we know?
Yeah, we'll see if they take it up. You know, these matters are not resolved quickly, as we've seen with other Supreme Court decisions, often, you know, petitions from the state. I think the first lawsuit over the Fairness in Women's Sports Act in Idaho was filed in April 2020, and it's still, you know, bouncing back and forth in court. And so this is a slow process, but the next step is basically to see if the US Supreme Court says, you know what, this is something that we want to take up, or if they wait a beat and see what's next.
Scott, you recently wrote an opinion piece about fireworks, and I have to admit, I kind of laughed out loud when I read the first line of it, which is, I'm quoting, quote, "Sometimes the Idaho legislature gets it right," unquote. You are talking, I mean, honestly, about something very serious, and this is fireworks. What are fireworks laws in Idaho? It was the 4th of July last week, and I have to say, even in my own neighborhood, there were some illegal fireworks. Talk about the fact that you're right. Like, this is so, I'm just, it's so frustrating just from a personal standpoint where I'm like, there's a reason why certain fireworks are illegal, folks.
And it is. It's enshrined in state law. It's the Fireworks Act of 1997. The state legislators recognize that these aerial fireworks are hazardous because we live in a dry, high desert climate, and they can cause fires. They get out of control, and sparks can land out in dry territory or on somebody's roof and cause fires. And we have had a history of fires. The Table Rock fire in 2016 destroyed a home and burned 2,500 acres. At that same year, there was another fireworks caused fire in over in eastern Idaho that burned 50,000 acres. And then this year too, we saw, you know, an increase. We saw a couple of house fires in Boise. There were house fires and business fires all over the state in North Idaho and in western Idaho. Boise Fire Department responded to 31 fires this year, up from 25 last year. So there's a reason that the Idaho legislators passed this law. And illegal means illegal, even though you might go into a fireworks stand in Idaho and sign a little piece of paper, a waiver that says, I am buying these, but I'm not going to set them off in Idaho. I'm going to set them off somewhere else in a state where it's legal. Wink, wink, nod, nod. And really, that waiver is made up. It has no legal viability. It is just a completely made up, probably for liability purposes, for the fireworks stands that are selling these illegal fireworks. The Attorney General's office a few years ago weighed in and said, no, illegal means illegal. You can't sell them in Idaho either. And yet, hundreds, thousands of people buy them every year and set them off and cause fires. And I suspect as our temperatures are reaching 110 degrees this time of year, this is going to become more and more of a problem. And it's worth a yearly reminder that these fireworks are illegal to buy and to set off and just enjoy the sanctioned legal events that we have here in the Treasure Valley.
Well, and then on top of it, though, Scott, one of the Ada County commissioners, Ryan Davidson, and this is what, the fourth year in a row he's done this, he's actually voted against the county's ordinance banning all fireworks. I mean, he basically says it's not going to accomplish what it set out to do. And I'm like, are you sure about that?
It's such a bizarre logic. I just don't understand it. And so Ada County goes above and beyond the statewide ban. They ban all fireworks in unincorporated Ada County, recognizing that a lot of these parts of unincorporated Ada County are rural and high desert and pose an even greater hazard. And so they pass this ordinance every year. They've done it for several years. And Commissioner Ryan Davidson has voted against it every year that he's been in office, saying that, well, people are still going to break the law. They're still going to do it, even if there's a ban. Well, sure. there's speed limits and people still speed. Does that mean you get rid of the speed limit? Noise ordinances, littering, should we just get rid of those because people violate those laws? It's just such a bizarre argument to me that we should just get rid of all laws. Fortunately, Tom Daley and Rod Beck, Commissioners Rod Beck and Tom Daley, they voted, they overruled Commissioner Davidson and passed that ordinance. And in fact, we did have a teenager setting off fireworks in unincorporated Ada County and got a fine for starting a fire. So ordinances work, laws work, and it's a good thing that they've got that in place.
Well, and we should say that the AG's office too, Scott, has made it very clear that even though people sell these illegal fireworks, and as you said, you oh, just sign this paper, it's all fine.
Right.
It's illegal.
Right. And a few years, several years ago, I wrote a kind of a tongue-in-cheek column about imagine going into your convenience store and buying a bag of marijuana in Idaho and say and signing a piece of paper saying, well, don't worry, I'm not going to smoke it in Idaho. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, we wouldn't allow that to happen. We wouldn't allow convenience stores to sell marijuana just because you signed a piece of paper that you're going to smoke it in Oregon. So it's just kind of ridiculous that we have this law on the books. It's ignored widely. It causes fires every year. And I say that if you really do want to have fireworks, then lobby the legislature and get it, the law overturned. But until then, that's the law of the land.
All I'm hearing is you guys hate freedom.
That's right.
We just want a citizen's initiative about fireworks, Melissa. That's all.
Make it happen.
I know. Okay. So, Melissa, a lot of people in political leadership roles, local to national, are voicing their thoughts on whether or not President Biden should stay in the race for president. Boise's mayor recently spoke out on this. What does she have to say?
Right. And there's nothing I can add about this national conversation that's unfolding about Biden right now. But what I will say, you know, is a couple days ago, the Biden campaign sent out a press release saying Democratic mayors are all in for Biden-Harris. And included in there was Boise's mayor, Mayor McLean, saying, last night I joined mayors to talk with President Joe Biden. He was fired up and ready to continue our work of investing in Boise and America. She was one of the mayors that they cited as being all in for Biden. I thought it was interesting, the mayors that the Biden campaign highlighted. There were obvious ones like, you know, New York City Mayor Eric Adams and the Los Angeles mayor and the Albany, I mean, blue states, but they picked Boise's mayor as one of them, the blueberry and tomato soup that Boise is.
Exactly.
You know, highlighted her in their press release. And so, so just a side note in this ongoing an unfolding drama that's happening around us.
Absolutely, yeah. Melissa, tell us what America 250 is, but also Idaho Public Television will have a role in this.
Oh, Gemma, I'm so excited. America 250 is a nationwide nonpartisan project to celebrate the upcoming 250th anniversary of the adoption of Declaration of Independence. Last week on Idaho Day, Governor Little signed a proclamation to launch this initiative within our state. And it's a multi-state agency collaboration. There are going to be multiple projects and events, and it includes the Secretary of State's office, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Department of Agriculture, Commission of Arts, the Historical Society, of course, the libraries, and then Idaho Public Television, as well as other, I think Idaho Transportation Department is linked into this with their historical road signs. I mean, there are so many different ways in which all of these state agencies and Idaho Public Television as one touch base with history in the course of our work. And so we're working with America 250, the national, this national effort to highlight Idaho's role in American history. I don't think Idaho Public Television is quite ready to say exactly what we're going to be doing, but I've been involved. I've been in meetings all week. I'm so excited to get started on this project. We've got 2 years of nerding out about Idaho history ahead of us, and I'm pumped. There's a little bit of information at america250.idaho.gov. If folks want to go there, and communities across Idaho are encouraged to submit events to the website leading up to this 250th anniversary.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah, I'm genuinely excited about this, Gemma. Wait and see. I think starting next year, you'll start to see a lot more around this initiative popping up.
So we should say, when we say America 250, as you said, it's the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So that'll be July 4th of 2026. And yeah, it seems like 2 years is a long time, Melissa, but it's going to come fast.
It's especially with the amount of work I think that some of us have ahead of us. And so
Yeah.
I like I said, I've been in meetings all week. I know a number of other agencies are ready to hit the ground running with some of their initiatives. And so I it's going to be a really, really cool celebration of America in 2 years.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to have a very small part in it.
Well, I think it's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. I know you have to jet, Melissa, so thank you so much for being with us this hour. And Scott, I know you're
Thanks,
going to stick
Gemma.
around for, you, absolutely. Scott, you're going to stick around a little bit longer with us. And I do want to talk about next, just shifting gears here, about a particular gun range in Canyon County. They're looking to make improvements, but Scott, my goodness, just a horrible tragedy happened at that gun range just last week.
Yeah, this is really sad. This was a 26-year-old man was accidentally shot and killed at the George Nurse Gun Range in Nampa. The accident happened on July 5th when another man at the range accidentally fired his rifle while trying to unload it, and apparently was pointing at the other gentleman and shot him in the stomach. That particular gun range is free and open to the public. It's not staffed. It's not supervised. It's one of the few gun ranges in the state where it's free and open to the public just to come and go with no charge. But it's pretty primitive in terms of amenities. There's no covered shooting benches. The shooting lanes are not really well marked or designated. And like I said, it's not staffed or supervised. Now, coincidentally, Canyon County is in the middle of making improvements. And the county parks director told county commissioners in May that these improvements are intended to improve safety and shooters' behavior by making it a more formal and putting up more signs with the rules and having covered shooting benches and more distinct shooting lanes. There are no plans to make it staffed at this point, and that might be a good thing because it'll keep it free. I shoot at the Black's Creek Public Shooting Range, and it's $10 to shoot there. It's nice to have a shooting range where you don't have to pay anything to go there. And if they started charging, that might push people out into the desert to shoot, and that's not always safe. So, but these improvements, hopefully over the next few years, will make shooting there more safe, and hopefully will prevent another tragic death like happened last week.
Well, and I think it's fair to say, Scott, that I mean, this person who accidentally shot the other individual must not have been following really, the gun safety rules, right? And I just say that as the fact that I think so many people in Idaho, doesn't matter what your political affiliation are, you own guns, and it's incredibly important that you know those safety rules and you follow them. I mean, our 12-year-old has an airsoft gun, right? And it's an airsoft gun, but he is, I mean, we are diligent about him even using that in the proper way.
Yeah, and I would say most gun owners, are aware of those rules, keeping the gun pointed down range in a safe direction. But if you think about all the hundreds of thousands of hours of people shooting at these shooting ranges and having this one accident, I think it is pretty incredible. I think the safety is probably pretty good. But anything we can do to improve safety and make sure that people are aware of the rules and following the rules, because these are lethal weapons and can lead to fatalities. And so
Yeah.
hopefully these safety improvements will make things better.
Well, on a much happier note, it has been what, about 2 decades since in the Treasure Valley we've seen a new Boys and Girls Club, but that's about to change. There's going to be one opening soon, Scott.
Yes, today, in fact, today CUNA
Oh.
is opening its Boys and Girls Club. It's been nearly 20 years in the making. It's the first
Wow.
Boys and Girls Club in Ada County since in 16 years. The Meridian Boys and Girls Club opened 16 years ago. And the plans for the CUNA Boys and Girls Club have been in the works since 2005, when the city conducted a study showing a need, desire, and support for a Boys and Girls Club. And I wrote about it in 2006, saying, oh, it's coming, the Boys and Girls Club is coming. Well, a lot happened over the 20 years. You know, there was one of the sites fell through because it was a drainage easement. Then we had the Great Recession. And then the city of CUNA kind of was stumbling. And then neighbor opposition, it just kind of languished for years and years. And what I learned this past week was that this got kickstarted again because of the childcare crisis in Idaho. CS Beef Packers is one of CUNA's largest employers, and they employ hundreds of people out at their meatpacking plant in CUNA. And during the pandemic, they had a shortage of about 100 employees. They had 100 open positions that they couldn't fill. And they realized that it was because there were inadequate childcare facilities in CUNA. So CS Beef Packers stepped up in a big way. They donated $4 million to the Capitol campaign. And overnight, just like that, boom, this was back to the races, back on track. And the club was getting built. And over the past 2 years, they've worked on the building, and it opens this afternoon. It's a 27,000 square foot building. It includes a childcare section for about 60 to 70 kids. Then the Boys and Girls Club itself is going to serve 400 students. I think they've got, 300 or so signed up now, and they're hoping to get up to 400, 450. I took a tour of the building last week, and it is super nice. It's got a teen room, a game room, a STEM room with 3D printers, classrooms, an art room, the separate child care. And it is located in the heart of CUNA, with about 5,000 children either living or going to school within a 1 mile radius of the club. So it is going to be able to serve a ton of kids. Teens can join for free. The summer program is $35 a week for kids. During the school year, it's $25 for the after school program. But no one will be turned away for inability to pay. That is one of the tenets of the Boys and Girls Club. If you want to come to the Boys and Girls Club, you can come. This has been a long time in the making, and it's just a big day for Ada County, a big day, huge day for CUNA, and kudos to all those folks in CUNA who have stuck with this project. And many of them were there in 2006 when I first started writing about that, and they are finally seeing that day come to fruition. So ribbon cutting and grand opening today in CUNA.
You know, too, Scott, and I read this in the piece that you wrote, which I knew CUNA had grown, but it's basically tripled in size since they first announced this 18 years ago.
Yeah, when I first wrote about it back in 2006, CUNA was about 10,000, 11,000 people. And you know, we thought, boy, we're growing like gangbusters, because CUNA used to be, 500 people, used to be a little town like Melba. And today it's 30,000 people. CUNA is approaching 30,000 people. So it is almost tripled. And there was a need for it back then when CUNA was 10,000 people. Now the need is even greater with 30,000 people. And it's just great that it's finally happening.
Well, as you said, congratulations to CUNA. So good to see something like that out there. And the fact too, that it is, people will not be turned away if they can't pay. So critically important. Scott, thanks so much for staying with us. Really appreciate all of your analysis today. So have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.